Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Chris Evans here. Thank you for downloading this special edition of the podcast. This week, we spoke to a man who needs no introduction, but we'll give him one anyway. Dapper Dave, it's over to you.
He writes era-defining songs like they're going out of fashion, and he's been doing it for quite some time. The documentary Oasis Nebworth 1996 is in cinemas later this month, and here to relive that seismic musical moment is the man that's now quite literally Nebworth his weight in gold. It's Noel Gallagher!
All right, Noel!
Hello.
Welcome, welcome. So many questions. What a movie. Before we get into how it came about, let's just cut to the chase here. When you saw it complete for the first time, or as complete as it needed to be for you to see what it was going to be like, ultimately, how did it make you feel?
Quite emotional and proud and nostalgic. Three things that I don't really tend to feel. But I was, really nostalgic and really kind of, like, looking back at those times of the 90s, and that's kind of summed it all up, really.
You probably remember the whole weekend better than most people that were there.
I remember it being a very celebratory atmosphere. I mean, I don't remember the finer nuances of it, but yeah, it was a great weekend. I mean, it didn't rain. I mean, I think it rained for 10 minutes on the last night, but we didn't know it at the time, but it was our zenith as a band. But the weekend itself, I remember being very celebratory, and why wouldn't it be? And a good way to spend the weekend.
An amazing way to spend a weekend, either on stage, off stage, backstage, wherever, just around and about. And so the first Oasis gig, was that a couple of years before the first ever gig that was recorded?
The first Oasis... So Nebworth is 96, the first ever Oasis gig was, 94.
Because there's footage of that gig at the beginning of the film.
Is there really?
Yeah.
I didn't watch the beginning.
Yeah. But what's amazing for me was I thought, geez, that was an exponential, rocket-fueled rise to the top, wasn't
it? Yeah, I was talking to somebody last night, and we bypassed the theatre circuit. We went from those indie nightclubs straight to arenas and then straight to outdoor gigs. So we never did the Brixtons and the Hammersmith Palais and the Apollos in Manchester.
Which were all fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And we got very big very, very quickly through word of mouth and old school way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you say the old school way, but thinking back, it's like, well, how was it possible for things to spread that quickly? But of course they did, not just in the 90s, but back in the 60s with the Beatles, etc., which is sort of where all this kind of magnificently manic mania to do with music sort of erupted, was born, came to be for the first time. What was the first arena gig you did, and how did you feel before that?
The first arena gig was Sheffield Arena, and it was just before Some Might Say was going to come out. And a couple of months before, we were playing a gig in York in a tiny club, and our promoter, Simon Moran, after the sound check, said, I want you to come and look at this place just 2 miles up the road where we think we're going to put you on when Some Might Say comes out. And I remember walking into Sheffield Arena and bursting out laughing and was thinking, I mean, are you mad? And he was saying, and I was saying, you're going to set, it's not even in our hometown. I said, are you mad? And he said, oh, we could do quite a few nights. And I was like, wow. And then after that first arena gig, we felt the song seemed to fit arenas better. And then it just snowballed from there. And yeah, within uh, within a year and a half, we were doing like the biggest gigs that were ever put on.
Okay, and obviously with that, you know, because that is you know, you are on public show like never before. But the kernel of what you do is, you know, in the bedroom writing the songs or in the studio, and then there's a certain thing about the sort of compartmentalization of that energy, you know, in a tight space like in Sun Studios or wherever, where special things happen. Mm. And when you let that energy out, it's like letting the air out of a balloon. Mm. And so what effect did that have, you know, on the two-way street that is performance and writing and creation?
Well, that's you know, you're kind of writing the songs in your bedroom, and then you do them in the rehearsal room, and you've got your own little unit, and, you know, your band has five fans and you're all in it. And then bit by bit, you know, when Supersonic came out and people started singing the words, we were like, oh, no, people are into it. You know what I mean? People are actually into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then with every release and every TV performance, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was a bona fide phenomenon. You know, nobody really knew, nobody really predicted it, and nobody knew where it was going to end. And it was a joyous ride. You know, those were the glory days where every 6 months was twice as mad as the previous six months.
Yeah.
And was just going crazy. And then I, you know, the same as walking into Sheffield Arena, you know, they took me to Nebworth, you know, and to look at this gig.
Well,
and
there's a bit in the film where he says he turned up in his brown shadow, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, I've been given a Rolls Royce by creation for Christmas because I'd made them all billionaires. And we're on the way to Southampton to start a tour, and we stopped in Nebworth, and we kind of drove into this nothingness. And I was saying, so where's the gig? And they're saying, well, this is it. And I was like, but yeah, but where? And they were saying, no, this is it.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And I was like, where's the stage going to be? And they said, well, the stage is going to be down there in a different county, you know. And I mean, I trusted my promoters and management completely, yeah, and still do to this day. And I was like, okay. If you think it's gonna work, it's gonna work. But they were, and then when you see the film, it's a brilliant snapshot of, you know, nobody with phones and tweeting. And,
no, let's get into that. Let's get into that. Okay, so when was the idea mooted of the Nebworth gigs? You know, can you recall the first conversation you had, not with the word Nebworth in it, because obviously that was a later decision, because it was like, okay, we're going to have these massive gigs, where are we going to have them? Several options. How did the mega gig conversation come about?
Well, we'd sold a lot of, Morning Glory was selling a lot of records.
Right.
And, you know, these promoters, they do the numbers, and I guess if you sell X amount of records, they are confident they can shift X amount of tickets. And the summer was coming up, and I remember there was going to be a big one in Scotland, and there was going to be a big one down south. We'd already done Main Road, it's going to be a big one down south, and it was either going to be Donington, which we felt was too heavy metal, or it was going to be some other big place we'd never heard of, or Nebworth. And Nebworth appealed to us because Led Zeppelin had played there and Pink Floyd.
Right.
And it was just, these were going to be our big summer gigs. We never thought anything of it. We never thought we'd be sitting here talking about it 25 years later. And yeah, they were just, you know, the band were in a kind of we're in a little bubble, and we were just kind of doing our thing.
Happy bubble? How happy? On a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you see the film, there's no me and Liam are getting on great, and it's they were the best days, which is why the Supersonic documentary focused on that period of it, because the fallout hadn't started to happen then. But we had a complete trust in the people around us, and if they said we're going to do this,
why did you pause then? What were you reflecting on then?
Because it didn't end great, you know. It was a slow death. It was a death by a thousand arguments, you know.
Yeah.
But at that time, you know, you see it in the film, there's a great camaraderie between the band and its fans on stage. And I'm glad that it didn't come out at the time. I'm glad it's coming out now, so yeah, all of us have got a little bit more perspective about it.
It's great. I mean, that's very interesting that you say that. You know, all of us, and you pointed at yourself then, all of us have got a bit more perspective about it. Mm. Just speak to that a bit more, if you don't mind.
Well, if we'd have filmed it, and it had come out at the time, yep, obviously we wouldn't be sat here now doing this, and we wouldn't have a perspective looking back on the 90s for what they were,
right,
and the way society is now and all the things that have changed the world, the internet and all the mobile phones and all that. So that would be a done thing now, and it would be gone. So it's nice that we left it alone for this amount of time.
Yeah.
And we can look back and discuss. For me, like what I found really fascinating is this: is if you look at the makeup of the crowd, they don't look physically that different than people today, right? The hairstyles are kind of the same. And the clothes are kind of the same, and it's the kind of makeup of a festival crowd. So that's 25 years ago. But if you were to go 25 years back from 1996, it's another planet.
Yeah.
You know, it's all black and white and greased hair, and everybody dressed like their parents. And I think that youth culture has slowed down a lot now, whereas not, bar the internet, not a great deal has happened in youth culture in the last 25 years.
So. Was it always going to be two gigs? Was it always going to be two nights? Or was it, let's see how one goes and then...
No, it was always going to be two.
Right.
There was always going to be two. Yeah.
And it's been said since it could have been 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, we could have done seven. And
2 million people trying to get tickets.
Yeah.
That's that day.
Yeah, it's mad. And I remember coming off stage and being in the dressing room with all the promoters and all the band and friends and that. And one of the promoters saying, "So what now?" And I was like, you know, with the bravado of youth and Guinness.
How about a beer?
Yeah. Well, we'll do it next year. We'll do five nights next year. And one of the promoters, I remember him saying to me, "Yeah, we could actually do five nights next year because we'll be able to sell the tickets over the internet." And I was like, "What's that?"
No way.
And he was saying, "Yeah, the internet. We could sell tickets now because there's a way of doing it." And he outlined this thing. And I was like, "The internet? That's never going to catch on. The internet. Who'd want to be contactable 24 hours a day? Who in their right mind would want that?" And as we sit here today now in your little evil black fridge that goes everywhere with you is your boss, you know.
So before the gig, I mean, you know, again, amazing, exclusive, because it's your film and your band and it's your motion picture, and you know, you have the keys to the kingdom, as it were, from a vault and archive point of view. You seem really relaxed, you know, there's a sense of focus, but you didn't seem that nervous backstage. What's great about these massive events that you and I both lucky enough to have been involved in is that actually, you know, there's a ring of steel, there's chaos often, you know, gorgeous, happy chaos, hopefully, around what's going on. But when the band make the way from the backstage area to the stage, it's just the band. And it's funny, isn't it? Because you could be walking for a bus.
Yeah.
Because there's this sort of cavernous nothingness between where people are, the limits of where people are allowed to be, and then the microphones and the guitars. And that, just talking about that now makes that moment, there's a moment, isn't there, where there's maybe one security guard or a stage manager.
Well, there's when, you know, we always just have people backstage before the gig to relieve the tension of kind of just walking around in circles and
waiting.
Yeah, it's the, you know, there's the knock on the door, and the tour manager will say to everybody, "It's 30 minutes, you've all got to leave." And then there's that half an hour where you start to get ready, and then it's just usually the five band and a couple of you, and that's it. And it's the seven core people.
Yeah.
And
what's that walk like? Just describe that walk for us, if you don't mind.
For me personally, I used to get very excited and not nervous. I was very excited about it. I knew that I wasn't going to be required to do on the stage anything that I'd not done 1,000 times. I knew that, you know, the albums had sold bucket loads. All we've got to do is turn up and be ourselves here. Liam would always sweat buckets. Always sweat buckets.
Usually more before than after. He seemed more relaxed after the gig.
Yeah. He used to get nervous before gigs. And Bonehead used to get nervous. I never used to get nervous. But the walk is, I guess I've always liked that thing. I've always liked that thing. I don't know what, I find it difficult to explain. I guess because I wrote the songs, I would get more nervous in the studio because I've got to get this idea coming out of these speakers. So the gigs were always just a bonus for me.
Okay, and that walk, was it different to any other moment, or is it similar, or just the same but more sort of exaggerated?
I'd say it was no different to the one at Main Road, even though it was three times the size.
It was Main Road. It was a warm-up gig for Nebworth. It sounds mad, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What did you learn at Main Road that helped you at Nebworth?
Well, that we could do it. It's a first ever stadium gig, and it was in April in Manchester. I don't know, a genius thought that would be a great idea. and it was cold and it rained, but
no way.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But for me. It proved that the songs that we'd written and come up with in this rehearsal room, which is the size of a toilet, could fill these huge rock arenas. And the fans just embraced it. You know, the fans got on board and embraced it. And out of those summer of those gigs, although Nebworth was the biggest, Main Road is kind of the one. You know,
yeah, of course.
If Nebworth is Morning Glory, Main Road was definitely maybe, you know, it was a more contained and a great, great, great atmosphere. And it's the first time we've done a stadium, and it's amazing. Like walking out on that stage, having been at that football ground since I was 7 years old and watched my heroes, and to walk out on the stage and get a standing ovation, you know, in your hometown, is kind of like, it just doesn't get any better than that.
So I suppose that helped massively with nerves as far as Nebworth is concerned. So attire for the night. So you went on, because I know you think about these things, you went on in a jumper for night one, and Liam went on in that amazing white coat of his, which was a bit E17 actually, looking back on him.
I think it was a linen safari jacket.
Yeah, but he did look like somebody, a rock star who just descended from heaven, rock and roll heaven.
Yeah.
Tell us about everything to do with
I don't know where those clothes are now, and I don't know for the life of me why I was wearing a red jumper with black and white stripes on it. And then I bought have you got this in any other colours? I've got it in white, and it's like, and it is the Man United home and away kit.
Oh my goodness.
Right? So I don't know what I was doing there, but they wanted us to wear the same clothes every night for continuity and the thing, and we were like, no, we're not doing that, you know what I mean?
There's clothes for movies and things
for
that.
When it being filmed. But Bonehead looks like he's going to pick his car up from the airport.
Or go for an interview or something.
But Griggs was never the most animated of people ever. You just have to look at him sometimes and think, is he, I can hear the bass coming out of the speakers, but I can't actually see him doing anything. And Alan was always kind of quite up for it, Whitey, but Liam looked by far and away the best out of all of us.
He looked like...
But then he's only got the one job anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's to look, good.
But the next night he went for a jumper as well.
He went for like some...
It's like an Aaron, wasn't it? An Aaron sweater.
It was like some...
Roll neck.
Yeah, like some of the Dubliners might have wore.
Or the spinners.
Yeah, the spinners, yeah. But he even managed to pull that off. Yeah. You know, so I think... There's great bits in the film of like seeing Keith Flint, you know, God bless his soul.
Oh, let's talk about that now, because we've got all this to come if you have the time. Yeah. So the lineup for Saturday and Sunday. Tell us, did you choose the bands to be instrumental in that? Let's go. Do you mind me if we go through the lineup?
Yeah.
Here we go. So Saturday, the Bootleg Beatles. Why the heck not? By the way,
oh yeah,
Chemical Brothers, Ocean Colour Scene, Mannix, Prodigy, and then Your Good Selves. Just tell us about the composition of that lineup.
Well, we wouldn't have approached anybody, but we would, you know, and when a list is put in front of us, we were like, well, we're not playing with them. So, we can get, this is going to be the lineup, and we were like, we asked for the Bootleg Beatles because they're always good to get the crowd going.
They're brilliant, by the way.
And the Prodigy were obviously the biggest thing since sliced bread at that time. And the bill over the entire 2 days was a who's who of Britpop, bar Blur and Pulp. I think Pulp couldn't do it because they just got back from America, but they were at the gig, and Blur didn't do it for obvious reasons. But we didn't choose the bands. But you know, when all this has been put together, and I've seen the original poster, I was like, wow, £16.50 to see all that.
That was at Main Road. It's £22.50 for Nebworth.
Oh, is it £22? All right, £22.50. I was like, what would that gig be worth now?
I know.
You know, like £222.50. But I was fascinated by when you hear some of the fans being interviewed then, and then they've interviewed them now, and one of the guys is saying, well, these guys walked on stage and the Prodigy, and I'd never heard of them. And I was like, you've never heard of them? What? Where have you been? you know. And they were going, they started playing this music, and they said they looked really frightening, you know. And I mean, the Prodigy were great that day, as were the Chemical Brothers. As were all of them, actually.
No, they were all fantastic. Yeah. The Prodigy nearly nicked it from you, didn't they?
Yeah.
Because a lot of the crowd weren't. They may have been aware of the Prodigy, but they probably hadn't heard their songs, let alone seen them live.
Yeah.
And the footage of the Prodigy playing and the crowd's reaction, that was in the daylight.
Yeah, in the daylight.
I mean, to achieve that before the sun sets, it's sort of impossible, really, to get that kind of reaction.
Yeah, I mean, you know... I mean, I love the Prodigy. I love Liam and loved Keith, and they were actually that. You know what? They knew they were great, and they had that attitude of like, okay, all right, well, we'll see who follows us then, kind of thing. And it's a good job it was the era defining band. They had that, and I like that when bands are like that. You know what I mean?
So do I.
And there's a great bit in it where there's a sea of people, and Keith Flint's gone out into the crowd, and you can just see his little green hair, and he's getting in the faces of all these kids. It's really, I mean, they were a fantastic band. Like, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do without him, you know.
Okay, so that was Saturday. Sunday's lineup: Cooler Shaker, Dread Zone, Cast, The Charlatans, Manic Street Preachers, and then yourselves.
Yeah, that was more of the guitar one, wasn't it? The previous night with the Chemical Brothers and the Prodigy was a bit of a electronic thing. Dread Zone has always been a point of contention when we see this. It's like, who booked Dread Zone?
Well, good for them.
Yeah, no, I mean, but they always get... And they had a tune out at the time, which was great. I can't remember what it was.
I can't for the life of me.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what it was. And Dread Zone, I don't know. I have no idea. Unless it was a record company thing, I don't know. But... Right. If you're listening, anybody from Dread Zone, well done.
So the weekend's approaching. What was your memory of the ticket frenzy? I can't remember how many weeks before that was. It was on the news. 2 million people applying for tickets. Amazing footage and re-dramatisation of the things that were going on. People had to phone for tickets. People were phoning up operators saying that they couldn't get through. The operators were putting them through. People were trying to get other lines engaged so their calls could get through. Then there was cash. There were checks. Credit cards. I'm not even sure. Credit cards were featuring then in the purchase of all these tickets. £22.50. What is your... It's on the news. It was on the news then. It was on the gig itself was on the news. The whole weekend was on the news.
Yeah, I don't remember in the month leading up to it. I don't remember that. But I do remember on the weekend itself it being heavily... actually, it was on... I remember it when they did the weather. And they did the weather forecast for the gig at Nebworth.
That's so cool.
Which is actually the coolest thing ever. I remember I was sat at home watching it. And
you're Nebworth weather.
And we're now going to Chris with the weather. And Chris is going, and in Scotland it's raining, and it was raining. And for the Oasis show at Nebworth this weekend, it will be nice and sunny until 7 o'clock on Sunday evening. And I was like, no, we're on the weather. But I remember it being the application for tickets being a thing, but I wasn't really immersed in that kind of stuff.
So Saturday night's over. It finishes at 10:45. There's the fireworks and the curfew. What happens on Saturday night backstage? Bearing in mind you've got to do it all again on Sunday.
Well, we have to try and manfully keep a lid on it. Liam has always claimed he didn't know there was a second night, which is a nice line and all that, but... You know,
it's a line you got to envy that.
Yeah,
line.
He sort of managed to bring a suitcase line. Full of clothes, though. You know, I remember going. We had like a communal area where we were all hanging out, and then we had separate Winnebagoes where we had to go and sleep. And
so you stayed there.
Yeah, they wouldn't let us off site because they knew if we went back to London.
Yeah.
There's a good chance that either one of us might not make it back.
Or all of you.
No, the other lads would have been all right. Actually, probably where me and Liam were kind of loose cannons at that point. So we kind of sat and had something to eat and discussed.
That must have been interminable in its own way.
Yeah, well, I remember the next day getting up and I wasn't really hungover. And I was like, what am I going to do for a shower? And they took me up to the mansion, Nebworth House, and they showed me into this room. I'd never had a bath since I was about 7 years old, right? And this butler is there, and he runs me a bath, right? And I'm kind of like, all right, mate. And he's running this bath, and how would you like the water, sir? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm dicking my elbow in. I was going, yeah, that's good. So off he went, and I'm in the bath. And there was another knock on the door, and I was like, yes. And he said, can I come in, sir? And he came in, and he had a glass of champagne and a bottle of sparkling mineral water. And I'll never forget that the mineral water on the label didn't say, like, sparkling. It said, delightfully sparkling.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is it now. Mineral water has now become delightful for me.
Please tell me he now works for you, that butler.
And he sat drinking champagne in the bath thinking, well, this is great. I only signed off 18 months ago. This is amazing.
What a moment. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, truly.
So what time was that about?
That would have been about, I don't know, 11 o'clock, and then right. Would have gone off to catering to get something to eat, and then...
And then are you killing time or are you filling time? What are you doing?
Killing time. Right. Yeah, it's a long day then until you're on stage at 8 o'clock.
And that
or
can be exhausting, can't it? Doing nothing can be exhausting.
Yeah, I like to... If there's stuff to do, like interviews, I like to get involved in that because it breaks the time up.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was being broadcast all around Europe on radio, so there was a bit of that to do. And then there's guests to see, but I... When it's a long day like that and there's nothing to do, it can get a bit... I used to worry for Liam, because if he's got more than 30 seconds on his hands, he starts boozing, you know.
Right.
But I think the second night was better, in my own recollection.
Tell me why.
Well, you're more relaxed. The second night's when we always did these big gigs, big stadium gigs, right up to the end. The first night is always the second night that goes on sale, right? So what happens is you'll do a gig, and if you're going to do two nights, so if you're doing it on a Saturday night, the Friday night is always held just in case. So the second night is always the rabid fans who've gone out of their way to get tickets first, and you're more relaxed because you've done the gig the night before,
right.
And there's just like the pressure is kind of off, yeah. You know. And I always enjoyed the second night more. And then because, you know, you're going to have the after party, and then, you know, you've got to keep a bit in the tank for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they get to a certain point in the gig, not that I've ever done it, but I imagine, within the set itself, where you're on the home straight and it's just, come on now. Like, yeah. We're now having the party on stage.
Yeah, well, you can see that on the footage of Nebworth with about, you know, the last quarter of the gig. We know we're in the home straight. Me and Liam are fanning about on stage, and it's all. But they're up. I will warn you now, when you watch it, I'm talking to you listening to the radio. I do get carried away with mentioning that this is a historic night. I tend to say it about once every 5 minutes. So when I was doing the thing, the edit with the director, was going, can we take one of these out? And he was saying, no, it doesn't really work. In between every song, I was hell-bent on letting everybody know in the world that this was the most historic moment in all our lives.
Well, I think you're hearing that louder than I heard, just so you know, if it makes you feel any better.
Yeah, I'm just like shouting. This is history.
But you were right.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I was. I don't know. I don't know why I kept saying it. I should say it once. You know, I very rarely speak on stage anyway, as it is. I don't know why that was. But, and I remember the after show of the second night. It started raining at the after show. So we were all in this tent, and there's lots of backslapping, and everybody was, you know, and then we ended up going. We left the site, I don't know, I think the sun was coming up, and we got back to London and we're reading all the newspapers and the fallout of it. And then literally, I think we had a week off, and then it was right, we were off to America or something, you know, and so we were just like back into it. So we never really got to see the actual fallout of it, you know.
Yeah, well, it was amazing. It wasn't fallout, it was like sort of afterburn. It was fantastic. So what about the set list? You know, because as good as any band is, and as much as their fans want to see them, there is that furore, and you know, and never before or since, more than at Nebworth, you know, on that second weekend in August in 1996. But, you know, we as human beings, we get used to things very quickly. So 20 minutes in, you've got to start thinking about, okay, where do we go with this? How about the rhythm of the gig? Tell me about the order of the songs, because you know at the end of the film, you know, it occurs to you that you left out rock and roll.
I mean, I was so angry with myself. 25 years later.
Okay, let's go back before we talk about that. So tell us about
so the gig. Yeah. So luckily we only had two albums out and a bunch of B-sides,
which helps.
Helps. So you're kind of, the gig's an hour and 45 minutes, so those two albums, are about an hour back to back, and you got some B-sides. So we would have done Main Road and seen what worked.
Did you change it round?
I think we changed it a little bit. I think, as I remember, at Main Road we came on and did Swamp Song off the, and then I can't remember, and then we did Acquiesce first, I think. And I think at Nebworth we came on and did Columbia. But when I was kind of looking at the set list, I was like, we didn't do Rock and Roll Star.
I know.
What on earth was that? And the guy was going to me, whose choice would that have been? I was like, oh, that would have been my choice. And he was saying, why would you not do it? And I was like, I was trying to be clear, I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't do an Oasis gig now without Rock and Roll Star. It'd be the first thing you do. And I don't know. I can't work out what the thought process would have been behind it.
I mean, you say in the film right at the end, just before the final knocking, you say, maybe I was trying to be clever, which is that's so not, that even that sentence is not like you.
Yeah, maybe, but I can't work out why. And then I can't work out why we did two songs off Be Here Now, which wasn't even out, wasn't going to be out for another year. Mm. So I don't know. I'm really angry.
What was your favourite moment? Because when you sit down, a couple of moments for me. By the way, it's a fantastic film. Though I'm not just saying that because you're here. It is honestly, everybody's got to see this. You got to see this film for so many life affirming reasons. Because I said before we came on the air that to know that it made me both happy and sad. But I don't know why it made me particularly sad. But we'll talk about that in a bit. But for me, the two standout moments to do with the music were. When you dedicate a song to Richard Ashcroft, because that's really interesting for me, and when you sit down and you start singing Master Plan, and I also, Cigarettes and Alcohol for me is a bookend to Master Plan in a way, because it's you know, there's the greyness of nothing going on, and there's the Master Plan of the potential of everything going on.
Yeah.
I love that juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Richard Ashcroft dedication, and tell us about you sitting down to sing Master Plan.
Well, Richard was close to the band at the time, and the Verve, were they called the Verve then? Were they just called Verve? Had split up for the second time, and he was definitely going to go solo. So when I wrote Cast No Shadow, the lyrics of that are about a guy who's given everything to his life and he's got nothing left. Cast No Shadow, shines through him. And on the sleeve notes for Morning Glory, I dedicated that song to him. I didn't write it about him. I dedicated it to him, as you would dedicate a song at a gig to him. So we dedicated him to him at the gig. And he wasn't there for some reason. I don't know why. And what was it? That was the second part of that
question? So the second part to do with that is the fact that you dedicated the song to him, but then you said... And by the way, you shared the dedication, you and Liam, so you'd obviously talked about it. And then you say, get your act together.
We
didn't say that. So was that like...
Richard was always... I think the Verve was... They were a kind of a jamming kind of space rock band. And I think Richard had started to write songs. And, we were just saying, well, come on, mate, this is your time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And off he went and wrote Urban Hymns. You know,
so well done, it worked.
Yeah, so
shout out to your mate at the right time.
So you can thank me for that.
And what about Master Plan? What about you sitting down to... Because we'll talk about the fans in a second or two, who are very much the sort of voice track to the documentary, which is just so beautiful. The fact they were there then, being vox popped in the crowd, and somebody found these people, you know, in the here and the now, as far as, you know, 2020, 2021's concerned, or whenever they were re-interviewed. But the comments that some of the fans make about Master Plan, about, you know, about you sit down and it all goes quiet, and it went deathly quiet. And you mentioned, you said that on stage.
The hush, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, they weren't bored, that's for sure. It was an expectant hush, like they almost knew what was going to happen. I mean, was that the standout sit-down moment for you at the gig?
Well... That song is great, and I know what it means to people and all that, but I'm watching the film and I'm thinking, who's the guy with the harmonica? Why is he playing all over my song? And I was saying to Marcus, who's been my manager ever since day one, I was like, why have we got an harmonica player? And he was going, I have no idea. And I was like, what? How did that happen? And he's like, I have no idea. And another thing, we're kind of like, there's loads of people on stage loads of like string players. And I'm like, what are all these people doing? He's like, you wanted them. And but the master plan, yeah, it's kind of along with Wonderwall and Don't Look Back in Anger and Live Forever. It's up there with the great Oasis songs. And you're right. That used to be one of my favourite bits of an Oasis set. Because Liam would sing the previous song and then he'd walk off. So people would know that one of the songs that I sing was going to come out. So it was either going to be Half the World Away or Don't Look Back in Anger or The Master Plan at that point. So there was like a hush. And there's a points in the film where, you know, they've interviewed, like Chris just said, they've interviewed people then and they found them now. And there's one of, like, a guy who was there with his brother to watch these two brothers, and he's saying his brother's now passed away and all that, and it's kind of heartbreaking. And to hear the fans' stories of their journey to Nebworth and then at Nebworth and then now where they are in their life, it was kind of, like, really emotional for me. Because we're all in our 50s now, you know what I mean? And life has changed so much. And I never took for granted what Oasis meant to people and what still means to people, but my God, it brings it home what it actually was all about, you know. And I'm glad I didn't realise it then. It might have been too much, you know, that people devoted their lives to this band. It might have been too much pressure for me to keep writing, you know. But yeah, I mean, God bless them. God bless them. They made it what it was.
So did you see? Well, of course you did.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of my favorite bits of the film, if you can have favourite bits in a film, because it's just a chunk of joy, is when the girl in the audience, she's asked by one of the filmmakers on the day, if you could give them anything, what would you give them? And she says, I would give them the power to be invisible so they could enjoy this. Come out,
yeah,
and enjoy.
Amazing quote, that, isn't it?
Wow.
Unbelievable.
So cool, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was like, if anybody's got that gift, can I have that, please? Strictly just to buy underwear without being... can't get a quick picture, please. But yeah, the power to be invisible so they could feel what we...
But what a generous, selfless, profound thought in the middle of that
That's
madness.
Amazing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wonder what she's doing for a living now.
Who knows? Probably.
But with thoughts like that going around,
making algorithms for an arms dealer.
But such wisdom. I mean, that was out of nowhere, wasn't it? That was such a cool thing to say.
A girl I was talking to you before we started, the makeup of the crowd is all split boys and girls.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems equally to me. And Oasis, for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, towards the end had fallen into this yobbish kind of thing where it became a lads thing. And... But at that point, up to Nebworth, it was a cross section of boys and girls, you know, and older people and younger people. Whereas in the 2000s, it became something else, you know, it became like this yobbish call card, I think. But I mean, thank God that little period of Oasis has been captured on film forever.
Well, it's like the pyramids, isn't it? You know, the pyramids were built for a reason, and then it became a tourist attraction. Yeah. It's not dissimilar.
Yeah.
The obvious question is... Not the obvious question.
How much do we get paid?
Well, no, that is a good question, actually.
I have no idea.
You brought it up, not me.
I have no idea.
But I can't believe Simon was doing what he's doing now so well still. But then I knew he was in the business and I knew he was connected with you, Simon Rann, who's one of the best promoters in the world.
Yeah.
But he was... Oh, my goodness.
Well, he promoted our first ever gig, right? And I'd known Simon because he had an office in this office block where I was working when I was working for Inspiral Carpets. And I used to kind of see him... there's a little like canteen bit there, and I used to see him. And what are you up to? Oh, I started a band. All right, what are you called? Oasis. Oh, are you any good? Yeah, we're all right, kind of thing. And he did our first ever gig, you know. And if anybody is a bar outside of the 5-6 members of the band is responsible for what we became as a live act, he had the foresight to put us in arenas and stadiums and, you know, big stately homes and stuff like that.
And also, he's not fazed by it. And also, you know, to create great excitement, often you have to be the least excited person in the band or the company, as it were.
Yeah, you've got to detach yourself from it and just say, this is what we can do. And the band have to get on board with it, you know, and we did.
And not dissimilarly for you on stage, because, you know, if you're given the party, you can't necessarily have the party. You can to a certain point, and you can meet the party, not halfway even, but you can meet it somewhere where it works. But if you sort of overstay or overplay your welcome at your own gig, it can go horribly wrong.
Yeah. Well, I was always good at running a band. I was always good at keeping everybody level-headed, you know, about where we were at and where we were going and where we'd come from and what it means. I was always very good at getting everybody together, making sure we were all rehearsed, you know, we're not going to walk out there, you know, like 90% of the bands, and we're just going to jam it out on stage, you know. This might be the one gig. I always thought that this might be the one gig that people come to in their lives. It might be the one gig, so let's make it the best night of their life, or let's try and make it as good as it can possibly be. So I was always good. I was on top of it. I was aware of it. I knew what we were, and I was cool with it, man.
Imagine if it was the first gig you ever went to, because it would have been for some people.
Yeah.
Imagine if that was your first. Where'd you go from there?
Well, I don't know. I have no idea.
Good luck with everything.
And to be, and the thing, I guess, why when you were saying you feel sadness about it, and I felt a bit like, because there's nothing like that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and particularly in the world which we live in now, post-internet and social media, and when people say, oh, you guys should do Nebworth again, it's like, trust me, it was never going to be the same. You know, it's never going to be the same.
Then that's because collectively 125,000 people on both nights were in the moment, because there was no distraction. There was just connection. And that's the difference,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
You know, because they were all connected together. You were directing, what's that called? Conducting.
Orchestrating.
Yeah, orchestrating the obviously the music and the band on stage, but also the vibe and the vibration. The vibe is the vibration of people. And you can see that you're all, the whole thing, the audience, the band on stage, everybody around, at times, almost for the whole 2 hours, you're moving as one. It's a one giant organism.
Yeah.
And you say on the documentary, you know, the Oasis, you know, we were all quite good, but we were never that amazing. We were much more than the sum of our parts.
Yeah,
was much more than what we are. And that doesn't matter, because that's chemistry. That's what happens. That special things happen when you combine what may seem like pretty sober, inane energy together, and you think no, because you don't know. But if that goes without, then wait 5 seconds, boom, and you add the audience in there for that 2 hours. It was just so special. It is so special. What is that like? You know, one of Rich's lyrics, "Music is power." You know, and with great power comes great responsibility. What does that feel like, Noel?
You can only really get a handle on it in hindsight. In the moment, I wouldn't have been able to tell you in the moment. I would have made some flippant comment. But in hindsight, you know, I know, as you can imagine, I know a lot of people in bands, big bands, medium-sized bands, small bands. They never, ever will experience something like that. Not because they're not good enough, they're amazing. Just because we had something with our fans at that point that we hadn't been paid yet, right? So none of us were millionaires. We were still in the same circumstances as our audience. We still looked like our audience. I hadn't yet bought a fur coat and a top hat. And it's a magic time. It's a magic time. And you only realise the privilege of what it was looking back on it. And I'm so happy that we didn't take it for granted either. You know, we put on a good show and kept on putting on good shows and kept trying to do our best. The proof is in the pudding now. I could pick up a phone now. I could call somebody, anybody now, and give it the green light, and the world would stand still. And it's because of the legacy of the band, you know.
Can I read an email out?
Yes.
To you that I received from my friend Noel Fitzpatrick, the super vet, last night. Because I hope you don't mind this, but I forwarded him the encoded link to the movie. Because Noel's a massive fan, yeah. Huge fan, loves his rock and roll. And I think he needed it, right. To be honest. And then, so I come into work today and he says to this email from Noel, he sent me this at 1:15 this morning. I think Oasis at Nebworth was the greatest musical event ever to happen in the UK. I couldn't get a ticket to go at the time, and I listened to a bootleg recorded on a cassette tape by someone I knew who went. I was mesmerised. Did you see any cassette tapes of playing recorded in the audience going on?
I can't say no. Right.
Well, it obviously was happening, thank God. Maybe someone will offer Noel £150 million to get back on stage with his brother, who I think he really, really loves so much that the fine line was crossed in that rarefied creative ether of mad, messed up genius. I think they're brothers who love each other on a level way deeper than whatever emotional pain happened when they said things they probably shouldn't have said. Life is short. I dreamt once that both Liam and Noel had dogs. You know, he's the super vet. He's the vet.
Right.
Who both got sick at the same time, and they were both sitting in my waiting room at my referral practice at opposite ends of the waiting room, ignoring each other. And I went out and just looked at them both.
The dogs. The dogs are ignoring each other.
Yeah. And the owners. And insisted they came into my room together. They did because they both wanted their dogs to be all right. And in there, they realised unconditional love is all that matters in anything musical medicine. Like the dogs, I just wanted everything to be all right. And in my dream, it was. Boys who create a song like Sad Song have to love each other deeply.
Well, yeah, yeah, I don't know what the point of that is. But, yeah, people on the outside looking in, it's difficult for them to explain. I get that. It's difficult for me to explain sometimes. But in terms of the legacy of the band, since we split in 2009, the legacy of the band has got more solid and strong and bigger and wider reaching than it ever did. And, you know, some things are best left crystallised in that moment, I think. And I think if there was to be a gig, something extraordinary, some extraordinary set of circumstances would have had to have happened for us to be walking on stage again. I'm at peace with it all. I love Oasis. It's the proudest achievement of my life. But it's like once you've done it once, you've done it, you know. And I felt at the time it was a special thing. You know, and you can't keep going back there. And obviously, nobody knows what's going to happen in the future. But as I sit here today, a reunion doesn't appeal to me. And as for Liam, he's doing his thing. He's responsible for the legacy being what it is. You know, he's keeping the flame alive and all that, and good for him. And you know, he's doing massive gigs. He's selling more records than I am. And selling more tickets than I am, if you can believe that. So he's doing his thing and I'm doing mine, and we're both pretty happy doing that at the moment. Things are all quiet on the Western Front, Twitter. So long may that continue, and good morning if you're listening. I know you're listening. I know you're my biggest fan. But yeah, it's all good.
Because we thought we were playing with it earlier on, right? Just, and this is just, you can ignore all this. You know, if you did something at Nebworth again, right? Because you do have Sophia, who reads the news, right? Mm. She's 27, right? Biggest Oasis fan in the world, right? Mm. I think it might be a bit sad if, you know, it's like the Beach Boys, if we all go in our Hawaiian shirts and we're 75 on stage and off stage. That's not going to work. But we said, how about an age limit of 27? The iconic, you know, rock and roll age for so many reasons. You 27 or under to go to the gig, and no mobile phones, nothing. And just, I don't know.
Would that work? I was talking to someone about, I get asked about reunion a lot. And I say to people, look, Oasis was not, we weren't from that, the digital age. We were the last great band of the analog era.
Well, what about doing Nebworth again for three nights or four nights? But mobile phones not allowed. You get chucked out.
Couldn't do it. I did a gig a couple of years ago in Bethnal Green, in York Hall, where there was no phones allowed. You had to put them in a holster,
yeah.
And that.
Yeah.
It was one of the best gigs I ever did, and people don't realise what a difference it makes. But the vastness of people that Oasis could attract would make it impossible.
Nothing's impossible, mate.
Well, you say that. You say that. Bonehead getting his hair back. That's impossible.
That's the other thing, isn't it? Because you see your 1996 self and you think, oh, right.
I've seen bands who come back. First of all, you've got to be blind drunk because they all walk on stage and they're all kind of fat and balding and you're like, okay, just let me shut my eyes here now and see this. And I remember going to see the Sex Pistols. I'm a Sex Pistols fan, huge fan. I love all those guys. John's one of my heroes and Steve and Paul are great. I went to see them at Finsbury Park, but I still haven't seen the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, no, I get it entirely.
I still haven't seen them because I've seen them do that gig. You know, and Sex Pistols are not a stadium band.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're a nightclub band. So I've seen them. Yeah, I haven't seen them. I've seen them. I've seen John, Paul, Steve and Glenn, but I've never seen the Sex Pistols.
I think, and you know, Nebworth again, just, you know, but without the phones. And, you know, if you go and you got a phone, then you're a muppet. You know, people can be searched, whatever. But I think people would be up for it. I think people would go, yeah, I'll give it up. If I can get a ticket, I'll give it up for...
Do you know what is interesting about that night? It's that Oasis had a reputation, of course. And over that weekend, there was one arrest.
I know, I heard about
one arrest, and it was for somebody...
And that was Liam.
It was somebody, like, urinating in a bush. And I was like, they got nicked for that.
Yeah.
You know, but because I always had this reputation there was going to be this huge, chaotic violence. But yeah, one arrest, I was quite proud of that, actually.
Well, look, we've talked for an hour solid. It's been awesome. I could carry on talking to you all day about many, many things, but this is a great film. It's a great film. People are going to go and see it anyway. Tell them why you want them to go and see it.
Because it's a snapshot of a time that was much simpler and youth culture was more defined and there's a band on the cusp of absolute global superstardom and a nation on the cusp of coming out of Thatcherism and into New Labour. And yes, it's a historical snapshot of the 90s summed up there in that thing, the hedonism and the joy and the hope in the music and the irreverence of the band members and the bond between a band and its music and its fans.
Just before we finish, so you're 54, I'm 55, so you were 29, I was 30 in 1996. And we had a festival a couple of weeks ago, and that seems like a long time ago now. It was the weekend before last weekend. That seems like a long time ago. Your gig in this film seems like yesterday, and I'm sure it feels the same way to you. And there's something that happens in that time warp, isn't there?
Yeah.
When things that happened quite recently seem a long time ago, and things that happened a long time ago seem like literally, not even yesterday, like, you know, an hour before. Mm. And I think that's all right when you're 54, 55. I mean, it certainly was a wake-up call for me last night, and I think I've had quite a few of those, as if you have, you know, between the ages of 29 and 54 in the last three decades, two and a half or so. But in 25 years hence, Noel, you're going to be 79 and I'm going to be 80. And there's a lot more similarity a 54-year-old has with a 29-year-old than a 79-year-old has with a 54-year-old. And that made me really think about things. Mm. That I don't know, what are you thinking about? 25 years hence,
well,
I suppose...
I will be 75, but I will have grafted on to me the body of a 24-year-old that I'll have bought from a lab in the Ukraine.
Have grown.
I'll have the eyes of a teenage goat, and I'll have hair of a Arabian racehorse,
or even a Rolling Stone
that I've grafted onto me. So I look about 26. So I'm looking forward to it.
But what does it make you think, though?
I don't know. I don't look too far into the future,
right.
And I don't tend to look too far into the past either. I tend to live in the moment, and I don't know where it's going, and I think it'd be a good lesson for life is just not to, I think about today and tomorrow, yesterday's gone, but it's nice to look back with things like this, but not today and tomorrow is my thing, and you know, I don't 30 years from now, I can't. It blows my mind where we could eventually be, you know, if we're all still around anyway with global warming and all that. So I don't know.
All right. And what next for you?
I am writing a new record at the moment. So I'm about halfway through, and I spend the rest of the year writing, and then next year I shall record what I've written, and then hopefully soon, gig-wise, life will have turned back to normal, and I'll do a few gigs. And
what's the best thing your career and your life has given you?
The freedom to just, you know, just do whatever it is that you feel like doing. I'd say, and yeah, the freedom just to get up and go and do whatever you want. Yeah, and but I've never taken my talent for granted, so I always work at that every day. I've never taken that for granted, and yeah, peace of mind and freedom.
All right, thanks, Noel.
Thank you, mate.
What should we play, Live Forever or Master Plan?
Play Live Forever.
Okay, in a second or two. You ever dedicated an Oasis song to someone on the radio before?
No, but I would like to dedicate this to the Oasis generation, the Nebworth generation, sorry, who are, they'll be in their 50s now, like me and Chris. And this is Live Forever, 26 years ago, the way that it was then. And the song itself takes on a different meaning now, if you think about the words. You know, when I wrote it, I was 23 and had all my life in front of me, and it's kind of a fist bumping, you know, we're gonna take on the world and we're gonna win. When I now listen to this song, it's kind of, you're looking back over it all and saying, well, we did all right, my generation, we did all right. So this is for the Nebworth generation.
Oasis Nebworth 1996 is in your theatres 2 weeks today, and you've got to get to go and see it. Thanks, Noel.
Thank you, mate.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky.
Virgin Radio.
Thank you for downloading this special extra edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show with Sky. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe for free to get our best bits every week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.